distortion, a huge lattice distortion, a huge periodic lattice distortion. And you can look at this thing in any number of ways. You can look at us basically these pairs being ordered. You can also look at this dimerized surface as consisting of sort of zigzag chains like that. So there's any number of ways to skin this cat, but you'd really like to ask, what does this, you know, what is the underlying crystal structure, and what are the, in fact, what are the particular atoms that are responsible for these large motions that you see? You know, a few tenths of an angstrom is actually a large distance for atoms to be moving around on the surface. And this is not some metal where you're dealing with, you know, 0.05 angstrom distortions. These are huge distortions. I mean, dealing here with some atoms of these atoms are 3.1 angstroms apart, and others are 4.5 angstroms apart. In fact, what I've drawn here is a histogram of the nearest neighbor distances of these peaks of these atoms. And you can see that these distances actually fall very neatly on a bimodal distribution. Atoms are either 3.1 angstroms apart or 4.5 angstroms apart from their nearest neighbors.
That's very easy to see by X-rays.
And it is. It was. It had been, in fact. That's what I'm about to show. So, bottom line is, if this came from a normal, if these were manganese atoms, that just simply is completely inconsistent with any X-ray measurements that people have done on these materials before. So, these, because the manganese atoms, as you remember the perovskites, actually the oxygen state more or less stationary. And most of the lattice distortions in the perovskite oxides actually come about because the oxygen octahedra that rotate basically around the various axes defined by the underlying crystal lattice. And so, in fact, what's going on here is that these zigzag structures, or these dimerizations, are actually coming because what you're seeing in the STM measurement is not the underlying manganese atoms, but in fact you're seeing the oxygen atoms, which are at the tips of the octahedra. And so you can actually go back, and so the tips of the octahedra actually have much larger travel distances as you go into the distorted low temperature phases of the perovskites than the transition metals themselves. And so we're actually seeing here, we're imaging directly, and to my knowledge this is actually the first time this has been done in a direct probe, is actually imaging directly the pattern of oxygen atoms going this way and that way and this way and that way. And you can, of course, convert then these distances into tilt angles for the octahedra. Okay, and the tilt angles are of order 20 degrees. And those tilt angles are exactly the tilt angles that Paolo Radelli measured in bulk using diffraction. And so this gives you tremendous confidence that you actually know what you're doing. You really are looking at the perovskite that you said you were looking at, and that, in fact, for some strange reason, actually, these particular surfaces that were exposed, I have to say, by a variety of treatments, and also then studied because they were selected, of course, to give you the proper unit cell. Things actually look very, very, basically remarkably bulk-like.
Something's not a lot greater at the surface because they don't have to.
Very interestingly enough, no. The angle is exactly. This actually superposes what we've done here. Is we've actually superposed the Radelli structure directly onto our images, and so this, and it's very quantitative, Doug, because you know, of course, when I look at these histograms here, these distances, of course, tell you exactly what that angle should be. So what we're actually doing is crystallography on the local scale with STM. We're actually able to do crystallography.
This has been done in other cases.
Yeah,
the interesting point is whether it's exactly like the bulk.
It is exactly like the bulk. To within the accuracy of these distributions that I can measure. So to within, let's say, 2-3 degrees, I think I can tell you what that tilt angle is. And it happens, it so happens, that for these particular surfaces, it matches the bulk, which is interesting. Now, there's another interesting thing is that the size of these regions that actually match the bulk, you notice that they're always cropped. We never see more than regions that are, let's say, 100 angstroms on a side. you never see 1,000 angstroms in a site. So there may well be some, in some sense, these are the regions that happen to be somehow pinned well by the bulk. If you go to larger distances, and this is part of, may well be part of the problem, is why can't you do, I said one of the puzzles I wanted to pose is why can't you do this more easily with a manganite? Why can't you do better sort of STM with the manganites? And that could well be a reason, is that there's only a limited distance over which essentially you can match properly at the surface what you see in the bulk.
On the same line, what's the explanation for the general drift in brightness as you move?
Oh, there's always,
you've got a contrast.
I mean, there's always some drift, and it's a matter of also whether you subtract or not. Many people who do scan probe microscopy are always subtracting out some drift, and then it looks flat. And it happens that we don't, and sometimes we subtract, and sometimes we don't. But there's always some drift as you scan a piezo around and you're measuring a current. There are amplifiers that drift. There are piezos that drift. This is not. And any very pretty STM images that you've seen, I can guarantee you, has had a lot of Photoshop applied to it.
So it's electronic drift, not structural drift.
Yeah. And then there's digital drift to go take it back to no drift. Yeah, if you like. Yeah, Peter.
The two big pieces of surface that don't look nice, like this, are they all oxides, like you showed us before?
We don't know. It's sometimes, well, it's like the weather. I mean, I'll actually talk to you about some of the other pieces of surfaces. This represents, I would say, Bjorn can correct me if I'm wrong, about 5% of the attempts to land on the surface give you those kinds of images. But, of course, we've had huge numbers of attempts, so we have large numbers of such surfaces, and those are simply the nicest looking ones. And then I will show you, if I have time, because I'm grappling, I don't want to eat into your time. We've seen all kinds of other kinds of other types of things on surfaces which we think are intrinsic. However, we cannot pin them by their nature to the underlying bismuth oxide, and we're worried that now that we've seen very cleanly also these. So BITO3 rafts, which incidentally are also always of a particular quantized size. They don't seem to grow, again, for reasons that presumably to do with strain. We have some rather curious things elsewhere.
Hey, one of the things we've been very interested in, what would the impurity do with this tilt pattern you're looking at? So you have a nice raft, you put it aside. Mm-hmm. You ever find a simple spot on it where you say, oh yeah, there's something here that just disturbed this tilt pattern?
I'll show you some things to that effect. Again, once there are impurities around, you tend to lose the atomic, or once there's any problem, you tend to lose atomic resolution. Although, again, I'll show you this. So room temperature, where we see some quite extraordinary things. But let me just move on. So basically, the picture here is pretty much like what a chemist, crystallographic chemist, would have told you that, well, there are manganese 3 plus ions and manganese 4 plus ions, they somehow order, there's a different ionization state. Then you have big octahedra and little octahedra, and they tilt towards each other and away from each other, and that's basically the end of it. One could ask if the tilt, if the I said that basically the distribution of the distances between the tips of the octahedra, that actually matched the tilt angle distribution that was gotten from the X-ray diffraction, X-ray neutron diffraction. One thing actually that doesn't match is that these distortions here, okay, the distortions of the octahedra, which have to do with compression and lengthening of the octahedra, depending on whether you have a manganese 4 plus ion in the middle or manganese 3 plus ion in the middle, those from crystallography are actually smaller than the things that we measure. In fact, we measure somewhat larger differences in these heights. Okay, so here there's possibility of two effects. One is there's a surface effect, okay, where in fact the distortions could be the longitudinal distortions rather than the transverse distortions. So the transverse distortions look similar to what, or look exactly like what the diffraction measurements were giving you. The longitudinal distortions seem to be bigger, and of course there are two possible reasons for that. One is the surface is different. The other is in fact that you have a different tunneling matrix elements between the tungsten tip and the orbitals responsible for that reside within these octahedra. So it's quite possible that the apparent height difference between the two types of octahedra could actually come from not a real height difference, but a difference in the matrix elements which take electrons out of the tip and put them into the manganite. And so that's an interesting subject for study. It would be great, again, since this is, I'm coming here to a theory institute, if some theorists took this up and actually tried to calculate what the overlap would be between the tungsten tip electrons and the electrons in these different orbitals, and if there's an additional sensitivity, in fact, to the orbital ordering that comes with the charge ordering. And if this were worked out properly, the STM, of course, would become a very powerful tool of orbital ordering, as well as just simply the distortions and the charge ordering that we're claiming to see. Now,
Can they be deduced from conventional paths, or
is compatible
with that? It's compatible. Now people are talking about the 3.5 ±10.
Actually, that stuff is hard to. I think that some of this that stuff I don't is difficult to rationalize based on the extraordinary difference between the two octahedra. That's very difficult to rationalize. I think there's at this composition range, for this particular surface of these particular crystallites, I think that those stories are incorrect. But they may still be correct for most of the bulk of the material. But for this 5% of the surface where we have atomic scale resolution, I can actually do physics. I don't believe those stories. I have a hard time believing those stories.
I know it gets
just a quick question. If you see the charge on the oxygen, as you told us before, this is presumably the tunneling mostly into the oxygen on top.
Yeah, right, picture. Right.
Well, it seems to me from this picture, it's probably the PZ that sticks out,
right.
But it overlaps a lot more with the EG
than T2G. That's right. So you'd expect a different tunneling. So the tunneling matrix elements would be different going into this object than into this object. That's the point. So this thing here basically records essentially that difference, in addition to the fact that there are distortions. But yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. No, I'm fine. Yeah.
Does the pattern that you see depend on your bias quality?
No, not so far. But I have to also admit that we, you know, have a lot of, there's still a huge number of experiments to do. Basically, the unfortunate thing is these experiments, it's only our group that's even managed it. And so we have to look some more. But we haven't noticed any dependence. But I'm going to show you in a minute where things do actually could actually be a little bit more interesting.
Just one more clarification.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You said nominally building is something like 0.7?
Yeah.
The average?
Yeah.
So those batches, you're saying they're more likely compatible with the actual?
They're commensurate. Yeah. So this is actually what I don't know if you'd read this view graph, which I was showing, but we see charge ordering with a sharp gap and a simple unit cell doubling. Now, this is problematic if you remember what the composition was of this material, which is 0.7. And it contradicts both the stripe order seen with neutrons as well as optical spectroscopy. Now, the STM shows a perfect insulator. Whereas if you look at the data from the Cooper group on the optical conductivity, they have a rather smeared characteristic. And the gap that we would associate with our material is basically out here, is 0.8, but yet in Lance's group, they just see a continuum going all the way down. This is incompatible with this particular type of surface being the dominant or being the only contributor to the bulk sigma of omega. And so I thought I should share with you some unpublished data that show you some of our other surfaces where I'm not sure, to be honest, whether these are coming from the bismuth calcium manganite or some other material, but they're interesting. So this shows at 160 Kelvin, and what we see is actually stripes. Now, this is a problem because, you know, many people, you know, when there are many patients, I guess, in a mental hospital see stripes whenever they have a problem, faced with a new problem, they see stripes. And so it's true here, too. You can look elsewhere on the crystal surface where you see neither the clear signature of the Bi203 nor the clear signature of the bismuth calcium manganite in the form of this tilted octahedra. You see stripes, and these stripes actually have fairly short periods. This is not very different from the weather patterns that were seen by the previous groups. And so this just shows you some very nice stripes. This is over 10 by 10 nanometer regime. This is over 39 by 40. This sort of look like clouds, and within the clouds there are these smectic-like stripes. So if you were into stripes, you'd be very excited. You can, of course, do also nice, you know, scans here. These are images, but these are real things that you can pick up. They're real oscillations, which are very, very substantial. They're a few tenths of, you know, typically 2/10 of an angstrom, which then result in stripe periodicities, which are then becoming comparable to the kind of stripe periodicities that were seen in diffraction measurements. One particularly interesting thing is that you can actually go and measure the gaps, do spectroscopy within these stripe domains. And I'm just going to compare for you here what the spectroscopy looks for a 13 angstrom period stripe domain with that for the unit cell doubled domains that we spoke about a few minutes ago now. And I'm just showing you for convenience the IDV on the logarithmic scale. And what you see here again for the blue curve, which is this just the conventional sort of unit cell doubling, you see this very large gap of 0.8 EV. And if you go into these stripe domains, though, you also see a gap-like feature, but here we're dealing here more with a gap of something like 2/10 of a volt. And of course, this may remind you of things like this. It somehow seems that we have a systematic sort of dependence of the gap size on the apparent periodicity that we see in these regions, these stripy regions where we don't really have good atomic scale resolution. And we would suggest that these samples, which have an optical a smeared optical conductivity like this, might actually have within them a range of different phases with different periodicities, with gaps, each of which, of course, the longer the periodicity, the smaller the gaps. And what you're measuring here is essentially not an intrinsic sort of lifetime effect for any particular stripe periodicity, but you're just simply measuring essentially distribution of gaps to do with the distribution of periodicities within the bulk material.
Question?
Yeah.
Do you also have a scan orthogonal to the trace you were showing us before?
Oh, along the wavefront?
One.
This one?
Yeah, here also seems to be the two mountain picture.
No, we don't see any. This is, I don't see these. I don't see atoms here. I see stripes. This is the problem. I don't resolve atoms. It's very different from the image.
I agree, but on the right, I would say there are the two mountains again, right?
Yeah, you can see spots and things. As I say, people who sometimes they see spots, sometimes they see stripes. You know, it's sort of all depending on how far the disease has taken hold. You know, I just don't think I would want to make a living out of this, except to say that the one dominant thing I see here is some kind of a curvy stripes, which...
Well, what about the horizontal striations?
Well, there are, yeah. You know, if I look carefully, actually, it is a fact, and I think Yara can back me up, some of these, you can actually see atoms within the stripes. There are little, there are modulations within the stripes. The problem is that they're all one-time wonders. I mean, you see something sometimes, and then you can start to pick out atoms, and then you go back the next day and you see something else, and it's a little bit the same. And you really, to build up confidence, the only thing I have confidence in is these kinds of general striations we've seen very, very often. But to really pin them to particular crystallographic faces or atoms, I would be very hard pressed.
It's a technical artifact. No?
I don't think it's an artifact. No.
If it does the Fourier transform of this image, I mean, you would see only. I think that's what Arno's question was. You would see only modulation in this direction, or would you?
You would see. I mean, you would see only a modulation in this direction. I mean, these look like wave fronts here. I mean, to the extent to which I can do Fourier transform, I may have. That's what I would say. We'd see streaks basically, which basically run along this direction here. In K space, but these things are seen very, you know, with some regularity, and they're seen when you don't see atoms, individual atoms with a unit cell doubling. They're seen when you don't see the bismuth oxide hexagons.
So, can I?
Yeah.
Because the risk of being clinical completely.
Yeah.
So, is there some dimerizations or those stripes actually have some kind of like ridges, dark ridges in between?
Oh, I mean, let me just see. I can help you here. Yeah. Okay. I think the thing that makes me makes it most credible to me is that there seems to be a systematic relationship between the spectroscopy and these objects, and that's the.
Your traces go, you move your tip left to right or right to left in the picture, right?
Yeah.
And so if you go across and then down and then back, how similar are those?
Oh, if we retrace?
Well, not retrace, but if you trace, I mean, it looks like you're doing,
you're going around this way, and then we can go. I mean, these modulations, I mean, are you worried about getting tip stuck?
I sort of a streakiness, which I assume is an experimental artifact.
No, this is not. Some of the streak, the horizontal streakiness that you see, these are artifacts. These are artifacts.
Yes,
but the fact is the dominant structure, though, which is at an angle relative to that. I mean, this has to do with how the scans are actually taken and the type of subtractions that were done to correct the scans.
So if you were to use the streakiness to put error bars on your...
Well, those you can get. You can get some idea of what the error bars are, because this is coming on at a slight angle, and you can see that there's some noise in here, and that's going to come from the streakiness. But these peaks here are real. I mean, there's absolutely no question about that. And as I say, you can see it under any number of circumstances, and they have, you know, they have interesting curvature, sometimes going one way, sometimes going the other way. I mean, these are the data. There's not much else you can do. But I find it interesting, and I think this is not going to go away. Okay. Nonetheless, we've not been courageous enough to publish it, so this is why we come to workshops like this, is to tell you about things like this.
So the first one could be also a terrace situation.
No, terraces are out of the question. Terraces would be, atomic terraces, of course, would have much bigger step sizes. These are fractions of an angstrom. I mean, even though you realize how small all these effects are. I mean, these are, you know, these are two tenths of an angstrom. Are small, and so there's these are very, you know, in the STM game, these are difficult experiments to do. No, the intensity of states is, of course, these are done in the feedback mode where the current and the voltage are fixed and you're varying the piezo, but the point is, of course, the orbitals still enter into the visibility of the features. So if the orbitals, if you're varying, this is not necessarily a height. That is a height as seen through various orbitals.
Sure, but I guess, for example, like Seamus, you always have trouble seeing those variations directly in the topographs, so you have to resort to the
I know.
So in your case, if you went to master states, will those features become even more?
Yeah, probably, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you can do that as well, sure, but we haven't, as in this case, we haven't. In some of the other cases where we have atoms, we have.
Okay.
but we haven't actually in these cases done basically constant height scans.
Is it possible that this is just some charge that accumulates on the surface and ranges itself and stripey?
Yeah. That's the definition of a stripe. I thought it's some charge that arranges itself in a stripey pattern.
It's associated with the fact that it's a surface rather than with something intrinsic. And that I think, is my question.
You can never, look, I mean, you're doing, the only thing that speaks against that is it sort of makes sense in terms of having a distribution of gaps to do with different stripe periodicities as being an explanation for the sigma of omega. But with SDM, you never know. You can never answer that question. The only thing you can do is say that some of the properties that you measure match certain bulk properties. But you can never exclude something pathological happening at the surface. I mean, you never can do that. That's the problem with the technique. But at the same time, it has advantages. You can see things. But that's always a problem with this technique. Okay, so I don't know how much more time you're willing to give me because I think I've spoken for too long already.
And well, you started late.
So okay.
Another 15 minutes.
Okay.
We'll defer the clinical
question. Well, yeah. Okay, so now when you warm up, and in these regions which actually have atoms that you can resolve, then you can actually get huge regions of atoms, basically where the cubic phase has been restored. And in addition to that, you can measure IV characteristics, and they are now no longer gapped. You see nice ohmic regions, but you still see sort of a pseudo-gap-like feature there. But there's certainly an ohmic bit in the middle there, surrounding zero bias. And what's interesting, though, is you can, again, start to analyze in more detail the images. Now, globally, you know, you look at this image here, and this basically cubic. But if you start to look carefully at a more local level, as we did at the low temperature phase before, you actually discover that the atoms are actually not in registry, the all in registry of each other. They again tend to, if you cut through, let's say here, they tend to follow this pattern where the atoms are paired with other atoms, and sometimes they're not paired though. But there's basically two fundamental nearest neighbor distances. Again, there's a short distance, and then there's a long distance. The black arrows and the red arrows. A very remarkable. Yeah.
Are these correlated? These two binomial distribution.
Those are correlated at low temperatures.
I see.
But it turns out that you can, of course, color in. You can actually look at the same distribution. So this is what it was at low temperature. I mean, very remarkably, they actually follow a very similar distribution at high temperature. And so that even though the overall symmetry now has been restored, it is basically cubic as far as the resolution of these measurements go, actually the atoms, and the atoms are actually static on the scale of the STM measurements, which is a few minutes it's required to make a scan like that. On that time scale, actually locally, the material is still distorted as if it were ordered. Okay, so what you have here is something very, actually quite fascinating. What you have here is a system which locally looks just like the charge order phase, yet now because it's actually disordered, is actually metallic. So when you cool a system down, perversely, actually anneal out this disorder, and suddenly you get the ordered pattern, the ordered dimerized pattern. And so you cross over from, and then the whole system is insulating. And so, just to summarize sort of how curious this is, so you have the charge ordering phase transition, at least as seen at the surface in this material. I suspect this will go through for the bulk as well, because I see no reason why not. But what you see here is that at room temperature you have a metal, but the metal is actually locally like the insulator already. And has these strong distortions already, and they're just simply frozen in. And then these defects, this defective structure, actually anneals out upon cooling. Okay, so upon cooling, you actually get this, you get the charge ordered, the fully charge ordered insulator. So that's interesting. And so, just to reiterate here, at I have frozen local order above the charge ordering transition, at least at the surface. I have a globally disordered state with local order, though. This is in the metallic state. This cooling anneals out the disorder, so then I get a charge ordered state, which is actually insulating at low temperature. So that's the picture of the charge ordering transition that's seen at the atomic scale looking at this particular surface. So you have a lot of microscopic and qualitatively new information in addition to the quantitative information that we can actually resolve the tilting of the octahedron is in agreement with what the bulk crystallography gives you.
Okay, then say what happens about the ordering tension for the mountain height differences?
The mountain height differences actually stay there. You can actually see that as well. Let me just show you. The mountain height differences, mountain height differences are actually they're still there, but actually they look more random. So the mountain height difference, somehow the electronic bits, remember that the electronic piece contributing to the mountain height differences is less significant.
Does the charge ordering temperature coincide with the orbital ordering?
Well, I would guess so. But this suggests some sort of more detailed experiments to do now, because again, we now have a quantitative probe of these questions where we can actually see sort of transitions where from local sort of ordering to overall charge ordering, and it's very pretty because of course locally, it goes completely against one's intuition. Usually, you think that if I take what I have is essentially a disordered insulator, if you like, which is metallic, and then I order the insulator, and then it gets to be really insulating. Usually we think about disordered metals becoming insulating. It's the other way around. So there's some very nice physics here. How do you connect all of these units together at room temperature? When you know at low temperature they're insulating, you connect them all together at room temperature and they're actually metallic. And again, we have local proof of that. It's not a question of where did you put the leads. We actually have the IV curves we can measure locally. So there's a lot of very pretty, I think this opens up a lot of very pretty physics.
I thought we were saying they're disconnected at higher temperatures, meaning they're patchy and there are dislocations and others.
Yeah, but that's metallic.
And that's metallic.
That's metallic. The disordered.
It's got room
to put the electrons somehow, yeah. But I'm just saying, having grown up at Bell Labs where all the disordered metals eventually became insulators, I thought it was interesting to see the opposite case where you have an insulator which you disorder becomes a metal. Usually it went the other way around, especially in 2D. But this is just as a phenomenon, sort of interesting, quite independent of what material this occurs in. And so that's really why we should be doing physics anyway. So we have now a probe of these things. Now, one other thing to say about the paramagnetic phase. I showed you one particular surface. We actually look at some other surfaces, again, because we wanted to check to make sure we were on the real axis. And there's another thing here. This is another surface at room temperature. And if you look at this very carefully, you can see that sort of over here you see sort of cubic structure. Basically just the 1x1 sort of lattice. And over here you actually see the √2/√2 super lattice. In fact, what there is there's actually a domain wall between the cubic disordered phase and the low temperature √2/√2 superstructure with this as the fundamental unit cell. And so what this actually says, And let me just, the other thing that just shows that we're not, again, that we don't need to see the same medical professional. Now, some of us in the audience might need to see. You can actually do a scan here, and you can see, again, the unit cell doubling here with the heights, with that sort of the short fellow and the tall fellow, short fellow and tall fellow. And then you go across here, and all you have are basically just medium-sized fellows. So you actually have... what we have here is actually a domain wall. This is, again, I think sort of the first time, actually a sharp domain wall between two different states of this manganite. One of the charge ordered and the other is charge disordered. So the interesting thing about this is of course this domain wall can exist and still, we can still maintain charge neutrality. You know, there's no charge redistribution going on here. It just simply says that for some reason on one side of this wall, you favor the charge ordered insulating phase, and the other side of the wall you favor the disordered state. But this doesn't cut, but the only distribution, redistribution of charge that's required to make this happen is on the atomic scale, interatomic scale. It's not distributing charge, you know, moving charge over 10 or 15 angstroms and getting in trouble with sort of Coulomb, sort of the long range part of the Coulomb interaction. Here, we're rearranging simply charges within at very short distances. And then we're allowing some ordering to take place, long range order, of that particular charge order. Of that particular intra-unit cell charge order parameter.
So how do you know this chemically, these two units are identical?
How do I know they're chemically? I don't.
So just in this case, I'm just in five days here in statement, right? Because if one is, let's say, half doped and the other more highly doped, then...
Well, it's very... The point is what you're seeing, this wall here can exist without moving charges more than one unit cell.
Well, sensible can, but doesn't mean because something is different between the two regions.
Something is different, and you know you can watch this all afternoon, and then eventually it goes away. So my view is that there's probably some random pinning center somewhere that pins the wall, but I certainly don't believe that there's a huge calcium gradient crossing there. I don't believe that. But you would have to do some kind of you'd have to do some kind of TEM to look at the chemistry, the underlying chemistry, which would then might then get you into trouble because you might also be damaging the surface. But these are the results. You see a domain wall basically between a charge ordered and ordered phase. So you actually have phase separation of a particular kind, but it's not this type of phase separation, I think, is much more likely to exist than the kind of phase separation to do with actually moving valence electrons long distances to create essentially a kind of stripe-like pattern. It also gives you a possible explanation now for why perhaps in some of the thin films that previous people had looked at, you could actually sustain insulating and metallic regions. And that the metal insulator transition that we're talking about here is not driven by a change in the charge in the carrier density, but it's actually driven by entropic, entropic forces to do with charge ordering or charge disorder. So that the standard story that we hear both in the cuprates and the manganites about essentially two-phase coexistence says, oh well, there's two-phase coexistence because the charges move around, move long distances. It may be more subtle than that. Actually, your charges may not be moving around long distances at all, but you just simply have local regions where you condense out a particular order parameter where you can which can stably coexist with regions where that order parameter doesn't condense out, but that the insulating or behavior or metallicity are associated with that order parameter, not with the underlying charge density itself.
Question.
Free charge density. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I would suggest we have 1 minute and then we'll be further.
Yeah.
It's exactly the argument.
I didn't quite reconcile that you have this perfect checkerboard pattern, but still we are a three-quarter filling.
Yeah.
From that I was anticipating, we do have charge desegregation possibly over some longer length scales, rather than, as you now propose, a much shorter length scale.
We might. Well, we have those clouds with the stripes in them also. And I'm telling you the truth, this represents probably 5% of the surfaces that we look at. They happen to be the only ones where we have atomic resolution. So they are the ones where I have confidence can tell you a story. I can tell you these are, octahedra to do with a perovskite.
So and
that's all I can do.
We have this perfect resolution, then somehow you might say there is. It looks like it if you were x equal to 0.5, right?
It does. Yeah.
Well, that means you must have other regions where apparently the nominal dopamine is higher. So like
probably. Yeah. I mean, that's what I was arguing. I mean, that's what I was arguing before. I think the local conditions basically seem to stabilize effective doping in these regions where I have atomic resolution at around a half. It just happens to be. Then. Although it may not just happen to be that, there may be good physical reasons why a half is special. And then the other regions which I showed you have, so these are the regions with the biggest gaps also. So these contribute to the upper end of the distribution of gaps that you would extract from sigma of omega. And then the other regions where I don't have atomic resolution, you know, I can see, you know, other, you know, I see these, the other periods. But doesn't mean that I can't study these regions and say, aha, you know, I should actually see domain walls, I can see freezing of the octahedral motion and so on. And I can then use that knowledge and maybe try to understand the rest of the problem. But as I say, this is STM and this is the best, this is basically what you could do. So that just shows you that image. And so again, this emphasizes actually at room temperature, the gap is actually a little different from the when you see, actually there's occasionally actually at room temperature, we have regions which are entirely charge ordered with no wall. So except for the edges of the box over which we can see coherence. And again, this shows you that this little vignette here, this is the IDV for the essentially metallic regions and some of the insulating regions, purple type regions that you see at room temperature, slightly smaller than at low temperatures, but not much. So I would say that, you know, conclude multiphase coexistence is important for the charge ordered regime. And I'm not going to give you the rest of the talk, but basically the question is what happens in the CMR regime. I guess I'll leave you with that while you listen to the next talk. Thank you very much.
We have time for a few questions.
Yeah, I have another 20 view graphs. How many? A couple of words. So, yeah, I'll just show you the data very quickly. So the bilayer manganite that we worked on, we deliberately, you know, after we saw this, actually, we were concerned because this, we were on sort of the side of the phase diagram that people usually don't go to. It's a, sort of the heavily doped side with the charge ordering. And one wanted to ask the question if any of this is relevant in the CMR regime. And we really couldn't get any of the cubic CMR manganites in the CMR regime for more metallic ones to produce any sensible images. So at that point we decided that we might be better off looking at the bilayer manganites and try to go through the same program of first identifying nice cleavage planes and then looking for atomic resolution. The bilayer manganite that we're needs some explanation. We looked at a number of them. It turned out the one that works best, and actually the only one that gives sort of relatively reproducible, nice images, is actually this x equals 0.3 type manganite, which has the other interesting feature that it is the one which is very similar to the high TC materials in that it's metallic in the basal planes and insulating perpendicular to the planes. So it's the one that looks the most similar, if you wish, of the bilayer manganites to the high TC materials. And it also has, of course, at low temperatures, sort of this famous tunneling magneto resistance along the C direction. So we cleaved it, and we actually get very, very beautiful, very, very flat planes. And we get steps in these planes which correspond exactly to the recommended interlayer spacings in this multilayer compound. And this shows how flat they are. They're remarkably flat. They're flat to within, you know, with sort of tens or hundreds of an angstrom over distances of 20,000 angstroms. This is very, very different, completely different from the stuff that people had looked at in the past, these thin films, which have roughnesses of order 80 angstroms. And so I'm very strongly concerned that when you have these large roughnesses that you might be seeing other effects that are not really intrinsic. So then we were able to, within these long flat bits, if you look very carefully, you occasionally find patches with atomic resolution. And these patches of atomic resolution, the modulations are actually very small. and things look quite cubic. But I should warn you, the patches are actually always of a particular standard size. This shows you sort of a scan through one of the patches and shows you the tiny modulations from the atoms, which are basically measured in tens of angstroms like that. And interesting enough, these patches live in these flat bits, larger flat bits, and they're always about the same size. They're always about 30 angstroms on the side. You don't see anything outside. And the other thing is, when you do see them, they don't look like additional atoms stuck to the surface, because even the patches are basically tiny domes which basically rise to maybe at most about half an angstrom above the surface and then go back down again. And so that summarizes that. And then we did spectroscopy. We did IV characteristics as we lowered the temperature from room temperature down to, this is here, 44 Kelvin. And what's very interesting is that these characteristics basically go from being quite metallic at room temperature, low temperature, actually being quite non-metallic, even though this stuff has undergone a ferromagnetic phase transition around, or basically an anti-ferromagnetic phase transition, but anti-ferromagnetic between the layers, ferromagnetic within the layers, at around 100 Kelvin between, and it should have been metallic. Let me just skip over this here. Now, there's a lot of detail actually that we have now in the spectroscopy. And detail, of course, comes from having taken IV characteristics over the entire surfaces. And our data basically convinced ourselves that in these samples, the IV characteristics vary by point to point only to the extent that is dictated by the instrument. But there is absolutely no indication in these CMR samples of any inhomogeneity in the IV characteristic. Okay, so we basically collected tons and tons of IV characteristics at points throughout these, I mean, literally millions of IV characteristics on grids on these flat surfaces. We find basically no systematic variation. Basically, that in we find nothing of the type that was found in the rougher thin film surfaces that previous workers had looked at. However, there's some interesting physics that one can do by looking at the IV characteristics, looking at the average IV characteristics. And there are two sort of most important results are shown here. One is you can actually measure the chemical potential as a function of temperature. And you can also measure essentially the opening up of this gap that seems to occur as we go down from room temperature to low temperature. And this shows you how the chemical potential actually varies as a function of temperature, going from room temperature down to low temperature. And these V plus and V minus actually shows how the gap actually opens up and actually goes towards a fairly substantial value, something like 0.4 volts at low temperature. Very interesting is the chemical potential just follows a chemical potential formula for a simple semiconductor. It's just mu naught minus 3/4 kT, which you'll remember from teaching your solid state physics course. That was sort of strange. And this is an extremely, I mean, this is determined, these are determined with high accuracy. So it's rather amazing that for this strongly correlated Fermi system, which has all kinds of strange effects, that somehow when you do an STM measurement, they determine the chemical potential that just follows a simple formula. The other thing that one can look at is a zero bias anomaly, the size of it, or the zero bias conductance. And the zero bias conductance actually undergoes a very dramatic evolution where essentially vanishes below 200 Kelvin or so. And that vanishing actually corresponds to a gap opening up in the spectrum of exactly the same magnitude as is measured here at low temperature. So it's this zero bias anomaly seems to be dictated even at high temperatures before the ferromagnetic phase comes in. It seems to be dictated by basically just a simple gap. So for all the world, when you do this C-axis tunneling, this stuff, even though it seems metallic within the plane, this stuff actually behaves like an insulator. Now, this sort of amazed us initially because this stuff, you know, the material is supposed to be metallic, especially in the plane, and it's supposed to have an interesting evolution below the thermodynamic transition temperature. But then we started to think about what we're actually doing with the STM measurement. We started to ask, are we really doing the same thing that you're doing when you're doing an in-plane conductance measurement? Namely putting leads onto the sample and then looking at basically the conduction of many single planes in parallel. Of course, the answer is no. With the STM tip, what you're doing is you're actually extracting electrons from one plane and trying to move them out into some metal, in this case, again, the tungsten tip. And that's actually much more similar to looking at the out-of-plane conduction. Then we thought about that. Well, we really want to do a contact-free out-of-plane conduction experiment, which then brings us to looking at the optical conductivity and trying to see whether the measurements that we do have anything to do with the optical conductivity. And the optical conductivity, and this is not well known, actually, in these bilayer manganites, is extraordinarily anisotropic. So if you look in the plane, if we basically have the polarization vector for the light within the planes, that's equivalent to putting leads on, which look at conduction through the planes. You see basically sort of a Drude-like feature, low temperatures, and then this sort of this lower upper band transition out of a volt or so. And then as you warm up, this metallic feature, which has to do with the ferromagnetic, with the half-metallic planes, goes away, and then you're left with this sort of gapped spectrum with a bunch of phonons stuck in it. What's interesting is in this material, not unlike the high-TC materials, or perhaps even more than the high-TC materials, if you look along the C-axis, you see nothing of the sort. C-axis, no matter what temperature you're at, you're actually always seeing an insulator. So this material always has actually a quite large insulating gap when you probe it along with basically, when you probe it polarized along the C-axis. And so it looks as if what we're seeing, and the gap that you get from the optical conductivity, again, pretty much matches the gap that you see with the STM. So the STM measurements in this case seem to essentially be extracting carriers which are confined within the planes. And it's basically, it's measuring the same kind of confinement effects that are seen when you do optical conductivity measurements. Basically what we have are polarons, basically, which live inside the planes, and they move relatively freely within the planes. But if I want to collapse a polaron and take it to the next plane, there's a huge disturbance that's left behind within the plane. It's very, very costly to leave that disturbance behind. And so there's a gap. There's a large gap, even though there's really no gap to moving these polarons within the planes. And so one can then use this, again, use this model to try to understand the transport data in more detail. But I think the really interesting fact about this is when you look at zero bias conductance with STM in a strongly correlated system, it's actually not obvious that you're just probing the simple density of states for the carriers, you know, within the plane that you're looking at. You also have to worry about what happens when you actually take that electron out. It can be an additional cost to take that electron out to do with the huge disturbance that you leave behind. And that, of course, those huge disturbances are exactly the same kinds of disturbances that confine the carriers into the planes in the first place. And we have a direct way of looking at that. So let me just conclude. So now I've given the whole talk, including a few. So we have first atomic resolution images of the manganites. We've seen the unit cell doubling from charge ordering. We've shown you that atomic resolution is not found throughout the surface of bismuth calcium manganite. I've shown you that the charge ordered phase looks metastable at room temperature. We've seen a sharp domain wall between charge ordered and paramagnetic phases. I've shown you an atomically smooth layered manganite in the CMR regime. It's electronically homogeneous, even though atomic resolution is found only in limited points, actually. And last but not least, I think we see some signature of carrier confinement in these bilayer manganites.
Short questions. One or two. Okay.
Do you have an explanation why you don't see atomic resolution? Is it that the octahedra are moving so fast, or?
I suspect that in these materials, we have a fairly detailed picture, but let me just show you, this will give you the tip of the iceberg here. Actually, speaking of the tip of the iceberg, the picture that we have is actually that. Is you have essentially a metallic sea. You have very good screening within the planes. And so these are unusual actually in that they're metallic planes. You have very good screening. Occasionally you have a defect, and then out of defect, you basically can localize a polaron. And once there's a polaron that's localized rather than moving, then you can image it. And that is actually the reason. Actually, this is a polaron here somewhere not far, somewhere out there, where we'd rather be than in here. That's a tree you probably know about if you live here. And the point is that you essentially, the reason that these, when we see atomic scale regions, that they're all the same size, we suspect that's the size of a polaron. So that's the rationalization that we have for why we seldom see atomic resolution. Atomic resolution is always hard to get in heavily screened systems. This system, we suspect, is heavily screened. It's much more heavily screened than the charge-ordered case. The charge-ordered case, of course, it's screened much less poorly, so it's easier to have atomic contrast. So that's the basic story. Again, there's zero quantitative rationale for that. It's just that, basically.
Okay, let's again.